The Nevada Court of Appeals. This is our first case to argue since last spring, so welcome to our fall term. Unlike the U.S. Supreme Court, we don't take the summer off, so just didn't set any arguments. We're happy to be here today. This is a case referred to us through the pro bono program, too, so it's wonderful to see that participation. I'm joined today by Judge Bonnie Bullitt to my left and Judge Deborah Westbrook to my right. We have some of our staff here in the audience today also. This is Clark County School District versus Justin Smith. It's the time set for the argument, and we have Ms. Alessi appearing for Clark County School District, and Mr. Schrager as counsel for Mr. Smith. Okay. We have 15 minutes set for argument for each side. The appellant can also have a rebuttal argument. Ms. Alessi, would you like to reserve any time for a rebuttal?
Sure.
3 minutes? Okay. All right. You can proceed.
May it please the court, Melissa Alessi on behalf of Appellant Clark County School District. This court should find that the short trial judge committed reversible error in finding the school district negligent in publishing an innocuous picture of respondent Justin Smith in a track uniform. The short trial judge did not apply the negligence standard when rendering his opinion, which caused irreparable harm and error to the Clark County School District. The short trial judge was correct and concisely stated what this case is about and why we're here today. It's about the inclusion of a photo in a public high school yearbook that shows plaintiff individually running on a track in his school athletic uniform.
Ms. Alessi, I think in your opening line you said an innocuous picture. Is that what you said?
Yes, that is the term I used.
Well, we're here to discuss the legal standard, but doesn't innocuous mean it's harmless?
The picture itself, not the finding of short trial judge.
This picture is far from harmless. I mean, wouldn't that picture be offensive to anybody?
No, Your Honor. It does not. There is no dispute that it does not show respondent's penis. It is not his male genitalia. Therefore, it's not pornographic, and this is simply a student in his assigned track uniform running track.
Are you saying that the school's only duty was not to publish an actually obscene photo as opposed to an apparently obscene photo?
Well, that's a good question, is what is the standard of care? And in this case, the short trial judge did not enumerate what the standard of care was for negligence. And the duty is, first of all, Mr. Smith affirmatively agreed to allow the Clark County School District to release media, including photos of him in the yearbook. And that's on page 124 of the appendix. He affirmatively opted into. It's not, you're opted in unless you're opted out. He opted into it. And so this photograph, there's nothing obscene about it. When you look at it,
if he opted in, did the student know what he was opting into by viewing the photograph before it's published?
Oh, he didn't get to view the photograph. The Clark County School District staff that was in charge of the yearbook, along with the yearbook staff, which were students, reviewed the photograph before it was published.
Who reviewed it?
The Clark County School District staff, which was Monica Martin. She's the one who testified for the school district at the trial, and also there was a yearbook class. So the students also
did. Does the school district then have a standard as to what can be published?
Nothing pornographic. And to sit there and say, it was foreseeable, like the short trial judge, that this photograph would cause embarrassment and harm, that's not the standard. By saying that, any photograph of a student that they may think, shows me in a degrading light, which is what the short trial judge said that this photograph did, we would have thousands of kids coming to us and saying, I don't like the way I look in that picture. And that's essentially what is happening in this case.
Ms. Alessi, would you agree that CCSD does have responsibility for the negligent acts of the faculty supervisor?
Absolutely. If there was negligence, there's no doubt about that, that the faculty supervisor was acting in her course and scope. And yes, the school district would have liability for that.
So in paragraph 4 of the short trial judge's findings of fact and conclusions of law, doesn't the short trial judge indicate negligence on the part of the staff for including the photograph?
Just because he says it doesn't mean it was the case. This is a conclusory statement. He makes no analysis as to what duty was actually breached. In fact, in that paragraph that you just cited, Your Honor, he says sometimes it can be a mistake. Well, what's the mistake? Because somebody thought, hey, I don't like the way I look in this picture, and that's a mistake to include it. It's not a pornographic picture. It does not show male genitalia. There was supervision. It wasn't like any picture got to be put into the yearbook.
So it's your position then that short of this being an actual pornographic photo, actually displaying genitalia, there was no, school had no duty of care with respect to this particular student?
No, we have a duty of care.
In terms of publishing in the yearbook. So the only things that can't be published in the yearbook would be pornographic pictures, if it had actually depicted his genitalia.
Well, of course, that would, I don't think there's any dispute that if it showed his penis, we would not be here. But that's not the case. But there are general standards, journalistic integrity, right? So if...
So it's not enough that it just looks like his genitalia? That's not sufficient?
No, Your Honor, because...
Why is that?
Because that is subjective. That's not a reasonable person standard. And so in this case, it was reasonable to look at the picture. He's in his track uniform, which every student who runs track wears. And so to say that this particular picture, an action shot, should not have been included in the yearbook, there's no breach of duty.
Wasn't it the fact finder's responsibility to kind of stand in the shoes of the reasonable person and say, you know, as a reasonable person, I find this picture problematic? Why is that outside of the purview of the short trial judge in this case?
I'm not saying that was his job, but he didn't apply a correct negligence standard. That is the problem, and that is the reversible error.
As to the factual question that Judge Westbrook's raising, that the judge made a finding that you have to look at this extremely closely and carefully to say that's not what it is. In other words, that's what it appears to be, and everybody would think that's what it is. How many people are going to take a magnifying glass and try and see if it's something else?
This case is very interesting, right, to just talk about. To even think that a male genitalia would be long enough to hang out of a bottom of shorts that have lining in it is not reasonable. And so when you look at the short trial judge's complete findings of fact and conclusion to law, it's clear that he is sympathizing with the respondent and not saying, Clark County School District, you breached a duty of care. He didn't enumerate what the duty of care was or how it was breached other than the fact that this photo was in the yearbook.
Right, but haven't you agreed the duty of care is to protect the students from obscene photographs being published?
That could be one of them, yeah. And this isn't an obscene photograph. But you know an obscene photograph when you see it, right? That's what
the
Supreme Court said.
That's the factual finding. Remember, was it Justice Stewart says, I can't define obscenity, but I know it when I see it. Isn't that what the short trial judge was doing here?
But there's nothing obscene about the picture. It's not male genitalia. It's just the way the lighting and the fold of the shorts are. And there's no dispute about that. That's what the short trial judge said.
What if this had been a jury trial and the jury had made a finding of negligence? Would your argument be any different versus a bench trial?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Because the jury in a typical negligence case just signs a verdict that says we find negligence or we find no negligence. Or we find comparative negligence.
Right. I don't think my arguments would be any different. I think that the process would have been different. We would have had in there jury instructions, and that would have set out the negligence standard. We don't have that here. So if we're comparing apples and oranges, I feel like.
About the record, though, I mean, we're not sure what was presented below because we don't have a full record.
Well, and getting to that point, you have everything aside from the trial testimony. You have everything that the short trial judge had. We included, and the short trial judge said in his opening on page 479 of the appendix that the court has treated all prior pleadings, briefs, and exhibits as part of the record of this trial. So I know that respondent argues that you don't have the complete record, so you can't find reversible error. Well, that's not the case. You have a complete record. It's only, there was no transcript to order, so I could not have requested the transcript. And even if I had done a statement of the arguments, that wouldn't have changed the short trial judge's findings of fact and conclusions of law.
Was there a conscious choice not to have a court reporter or court recorder for this one-day trial?
On our end, of course, it's a cost-saving method, which is the point of the arbitration program and the short trial program. It was via Zoom.
You're not the only one in this position. Most people don't order it. But nonetheless, if you expect you might appeal, it seems like you would have it.
Hindsight's 2020, right?
Ms. Alessi, yes. Is there any dispute in the record that the visual impact of the photograph caused embarrassment and humiliation to the student?
That is his testimony, and you know, he did 2 months after the incident go and seek therapy. So yes, he did claim that he suffered some sort of emotional harm from it. But we don't even get to the issue of damages because plaintiff did not establish a breach of duty. Therefore,
it is one of your arguments on appeal, so we should at least briefly talk about it.
Yes, exactly, Your Honor.
So on to Judge Bullis' point then, there was testimony in the record, even though we don't have a transcript, but we do have findings that he did suffer in some way from this to the point where the short trial judge thought general damages and special damages were both appropriate.
Well, in terms of the special damages, again, this goes towards the idea that the short trial judge was using sympathy and not using the rule of law. He awarded $1,000 in special damages. However, the therapist's December 7th, 2020 letter states that a weekly session is $150. There's no invoicing whatsoever. So if you take $150 per session and divide it by the $1,000, that's 6.67 sessions. Where the short trial judge says that the treatment that he received was excessive or didn't really relate to the photograph, and that a few sessions should have handled it. So if we're talking about a few sessions, 3-4 sessions, that's not 6.67 sessions. And so again, the issue is that the short trial judge didn't use applicable laws and standards when he rendered his decision, which is reversible error and caused harm to the Clark County School District. I'm going to reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Schrager, you have 15 minutes.
Thank you, Chief Judge, and good morning, Chief Judge and judges. May it please the court, my name is Bradley Schrager, the law firm of Bravo Schrager, and I'm here for Mr. Smith. For a short trial appeal with the $6,000 judgment, this throws up some very interesting questions and very serious ones worthy of answering. But I also want to talk about short trials generally. Short trials are a mechanism by which small dollar, simple issue, reversible error sort of, or common error cases can be dealt with quickly and easily. And everyone in those instances is doing the best they can, right? But we have those short trial rules for a reason, right? So we can resolve these kinds of disputes in, supposed to be a rapid way. This one took a little longer than normally, but that's what it's supposed to be. And if you read here the short trial judge's findings of fact, you'll note that not only did Mr. Smith represent himself, but because of that, the short trial judge wasn't compensated, but said, we're doing this in the best way we can to mete out justice. So I want to focus first, because I think...
What about the general procedures? Should there be a transcript or a recording? And because you've argued that it's fatal that there isn't one.
It is absolutely fatal, because of all the things we know about what happened in this case, from the publication of the photo that I don't need to describe, to the level of distress and humiliation that it caused my client, to the level of a therapist finding that he had PTSD, right? We know all those things. We know how and why and when and all those things. The things we don't know about what happened below are enormous black holes for this court to be able to do its job. The lack of knowing what happened at trial is an enormous caesura in this case. It's not something you can simply work around and say, well, we'll just look at everything else that the short trial judge had, and we'll sort of intuit what happened at trial. Trials, as this court well knows, are the ultimate test of the claims in a complaint. They are the site of cross-examination. We don't know, for example, what statements were made in opening argument. We don't know what statements or arguments were made in closing. We don't know what questions the trial judge has. And if you read the findings of fact, conclusions of law, it's the work of an engaged jurist who may have had questions. Crucially, we don't know what objections were made and preserved for this moment on appeal. We don't know whether the arguments made below differ in significant respect from the arguments being made here to you, each of which would cause this court to say, we're not even going to hear this appeal. When you don't know those things, how can a reviewing court do its job?
Sounds like the question that they're raising on appeal is the fact that there was no specification in the order itself of what that duty of care was. How do you respond to that argument? Because that seems to be related to the order as opposed to what happened at trial.
Well, Judge Westbrook, I think that there's potentially an interrelationship that we don't know. Had the short trial judge gone on at length regarding the specific duty of care that he was identifying and enforcing here, there wouldn't be an argument. We would simply say it's subsumed, much like, as I mentioned in my brief, when appellate courts deal with application of the Beattie factors. They say, well, if there's an indication in the record that it's been dealt with, then it's been dealt with, and we're not going to overturn it just because it wasn't re-elucidated point by point in the actual order. The thing is, we don't know here. What we do know is that a fairly engaged jurist wrote a fairly humane and thoughtful order that speaks in the idiom of negligence, right? As we pointed out already, it talks about, or the order talks about, that the judge finds it difficult to believe that intelligent and even educated persons exercising normal care could have decided to insert this particular photo of him. That, in fact, points to a duty not to do that thing, right?
So let me interrupt there. Yeah. I asked Ms. Alessi if this would be any different if it had been a jury verdict. So we know a jury verdict in a negligence case is typically a general verdict.
Yeah.
There's no establishment as to each element by answering questions on something like that. In this case, she said, well, if there had been a jury, there would have been jury instructions. So the jury would know what the law is so that the jury can apply the elements of negligence. You've indicated the record is absent. There's certain things that are missing. I mean, do we know if any of that was presented to the trial judge in this case?
We don't. And of course, had it been a jury trial, jury instructions would have given us a clue as to the jury's application of the evidence and the facts to the law.
Right.
Here, we don't have that.
You're kind of reading into this order. Well, it sounds like something like that happened because the language that is used is consistent with negligence.
I think the way to put it is that In the first instance, you can't read anything into the trial because we simply don't have it. And we can talk about why we don't have it, which was your original question. But so in the first instance, we don't have it. The second instance is if we're going to judge from the order what happened there, it appears to me that the language of the order tends toward a thoughtful, unless we're going to argue on some level that we are employing short trial judges that don't know the basic elements of negligence, which I hope is not true, and I have no evidence of here, I think we have to assume that that's being done here, right? Because, you know, the standard we're operating under is abuse of discretion. It's not use of discretion in a way that I could foresee myself using differently, or you as jurists, or CCSD as a party. It's abuse of that discretion, which means there has to be an indicia that this is an arbitrary, fanciful decision that no reasonable person could come to.
Well, that certainly has to be factual findings. There has to be substantial evidence to support them. I think Judge Westbrook's question went to the legal issue of, you know, what is the duty? And again, it's not really clear what was argued below on that.
Which is the important thing, right?
But still, there should be something related to the duty. Now, I heard Ms. Alessi say there is a duty to protect students from obscene photos being published.
Well, I think that's certainly true. I mean, duty is in the common law. We're not dealing with a statutory provision in which we are interpreting words and applying them to contested facts, right? Duty in the common law develops case by case, right? So there's actually, you know, you don't have to name it so specifically. You had a simple duty of care not to subject this student to this humiliation, which the judge also said was foreseeable, right? You had a duty not to allow that to happen. And it's not as if, you know, he came over later and said, hey, I don't feel good about how I look in this picture. It's very clear, even from the record that does exist and in the order, that this was intense humiliation.
Right. So right? Since the judge talked about foreseeability, it appears that he's looking at the breach of duty, that this type of harm was foreseeable, and you wouldn't even need to talk about that unless there was a duty to protect somebody from the harm.
You would get to that step afterwards, correct? But let's talk for a second about why there's no record. And look, you're right. This happens all the time in short trials, I understand, because it's an extra expense and it's a low dollar amount, and you never expect to be standing here. But it's not as if there's no transcript because it was lost in a fire. It was not requested, intentionally not requested. Now, what happens when you don't have a record? The rules, the appellate rules, not the trial rules, the appellate rules determine that if you don't have a transcript, there's still things you can do. Why do we have that rule? Because it's important for the reviewing court to be able to look at a record and deal with it on some level. So what you do is, as an appellant, you prepare to the best of your recollection or with other materials you have at hand, and you prepare that. You send it over to the respondent. The respondent has a chance to weigh in on it. And then, importantly, it isn't just one side says one thing, one side says the other. It goes to the trial judge, who then weighs in on the accuracy to the best of that individual's recollection. Now, look, that's not perfect either, but it provides and underscores the importance of you having something to reflect what happened, because the trial is the place where it happens. It's the moment where the truth is uncovered, right? So if you don't have that, what do you do? Now, case law here in Nevada, the Cootsie case and some others that I've cited say that if the appellant doesn't bring to the court a record or there are empty spots in the record, this court is to presume that that record favors the respondent. And that's a presumption that I think is even very hard to think about how you would rebut it, right? Because you'd be rebutting nothing, right? You would be rebutting with no information that which you must presume to favor. It's like, you know, there are so many ways in which you presume testimony favorable to the state if you take the Fifth in a civil proceeding, those sorts of things.
What about the example of the damages that was discussed at the end of the last argument? So if we had the record, we might have a better reason to know why the judge picked the figure of $1,000 for special damages.
That's right.
I mean, there's something in the written order about it, so it's not like we don't have anything. There's something. If the respondent, Mr. Smith, argued for $15,000 and the judge awarded $1,000 in special damages and explained his reasoning that he thought that not all of that counseling was related to this publication of this photo, there were other problems in his life.
Yeah.
Is that good enough?
Well, trust me, my client was intensely disappointed in that particular use of the short trial judge's discretion, right? He would prefer to have been granted all that he asked for. But the way in which we trust, because that's how the system functions, that we trust in which the short trial judge reached that particular conclusion that's not challenged on appeal by my client or anybody else, certainly not by the district, is that the short trial judge is the one who sat there and judged credibility and what was said and how and weighed it all. So, you know, we don't know if the short trial judge in his summation of, you know, here's my preliminary order, what I'm about to, we don't even know if that happened. He could have been to the penny and said, you know, thank you for all this, and here's why I'm giving you $5,000 for this, and here's why I'm giving you $1,000 for that. We don't know.
Counselor, are you aware of any case or rule that requires the short trial judge in these instances to state the duty of care owed in the disposition?
No, and I also think it is difficult to expect, not just that, but if you were to have to enumerate any number of things in a short trial judge's capacity, you would be dealing with overturning, reversing all manner of short trial judge things all the time. And actually, that's a policy a point I want to make, which is given the nature of short trial cases, their value, the types of issues, they are very likely, almost always, to wind up in the Court of Appeals if they're appealed.
Yep, we've seen a few.
Yeah. So, you know, I assume you're thrilled with that. Your courthouse doors are open. You want people to exercise their rights. They should come here to appeal if they need to. However, they also need to understand what they need to bring when they do. And so if this strikes me as a tremendous opportunity for this court to make clear that absolutely, come and have your case heard. This is where we do that. We are open for business. However, you've got to establish a record, and we are going to encourage you to provide us with a record we can use. Here, true, trial was over. There was no transcript made. It was finished.
Do you think there's enough from having the written order that there's a record? So the appellants made its a legal argument. One of the factual arguments that was claimed is that it looked like the short trial judge was acting under emotion or some other improper factor. But you just talked about him reducing the damages, applying the credibility rules. And that sounds like the opposite of somebody acting under emotion or improperly.
I think it sounds to me, though, that I think that's right. What it sounds to me is a humane judge dealing with what's in front of him in both directions, right? Someone who has suffered this particular indignity, but at the same time may not be entitled to everything he's asking for. And that's, I think, what we want to encourage. So if there are no further questions, I'll go ahead and take my seat. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you. All right, we'll go to the rebuttal argument.
May it please court. There was no analysis of any of the other claims in the complaint. Respondent alleged negligent infliction of emotional distress, intentional infliction of emotional distress, and defamation. None of those were even hinted at in the findings of fact and conclusions of law. Again, that speaks to, not as Mr. Schrager argues, a thoughtful analysis. There was no analysis of the claims. This was, as Mr. Schrager says, humane. Again, sympathy, not the rule of law, which is what is required here. And going back to, you know, the fact that, you know, this young man, he did suffer something, but he waited nearly a month from the time the yearbook was published until he said anything to the school district. And the school district investigated, as they're required to do under the NRS, and they found they unsubstantiated the claim of bullying. And that was in the record. And so what we have here is,
maybe this situation escalated over time, and that's the reason for the delay. Again, having the transcript would be helpful because we don't have Mr. Smith's testimony on this, but just that doesn't sound like an inordinately long delay.
Well, Your Honor, if I may point more to the timeline, the yearbook was published, first published May 25th of 2017. The last day of school was June 8th, 2017, and the report wasn't made until June 23rd, 2017. School wasn't even in session at the time. And so what we're asking
there's a claim in the brief that this was published in social media. So once it goes there, it can go anywhere.
Again, Your Honor, that's outside of what the school district can control. We can only control what happens on the school, at school sanctioned events. We don't have a duty to, if a kid wants to take a picture and post it, we don't have control of that.
There's a difference from 5 people seeing it versus 5,000 seeing it.
Your Honor, I mean, this was a school yearbook. So presumably the majority of the students at Durango and probably other schools did see it. I don't think that the issue of how many people saw it is germane to the arguments
Doesn't
today.
Doesn't it go to damages then about what sort of embarrassment the individual would suffer?
Well, Your Honor, again, that goes back to we don't get to the damages because we don't know there's no analysis as to the breach of duty, and the Clark County School District suffered irreparable harm by the short trial judge's decision in this case, and no reasonable person would have come to this. It was plain error.
Ms. Alessi, do you have any legal authority to support that the short trial judge had to be specific in detail regarding analysis on the negligence part of the claim?
Not off the top of my head, Your Honor, but we do know that when you're analyzing claims, as Mr. Schrager noted, the Beatty factors, you're expected to go through them. And so you're expected to go through, you know, the claims and the elements, and that wasn't done in this case.
Well, Mr. Smith isn't challenging any of the other claims at issue, correct?
You're right, Your Honor, because there was no mention of them in the findings of fact and conclusions of law. It's as if the short trial judge just said, hey, this kid was, you know, clearly embarrassed by this photograph. Let me throw him the proverbial bone, which is not what is allowed under the rules of law of this state.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay. The court. Thank-